This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Governor Jim Justice says lawmakers have reached a pivotal moment at the State House as a small committee works to hash out the final details of his tax reform proposal. Justice has joined Senate Republicans in the push for reform, but as Ashton Mara reports, he's leaving some crucial details in the plan up to lawmakers, despite their requests for his opinion.
Governors usually send members of their cabinet or their staff to take questions from lawmakers, but Governor Jim Justice decided to take those questions himself Thursday morning. Members of a conference committee of both chambers spent more than an hour questioning Justice about his tax reform proposal, the bill that's at the center of their work. An idea that originally came from Senate Republicans, the details contained in House Bill 107 have varied widely over the past couple weeks. At its core, though, is a push to increase the consumer sales tax as a trade-off for a reduced personal income tax, along with restructuring the coal severance tax. But at a time when the state is struggling financially, some lawmakers have been reluctant to sign off on the proposal, and Justice has been working to change their minds.
To me, the income tax reform is a good idea. A solid idea.
But it's a complicated one. Members of both the House and Senate and the governor's office have visited various proposals to decrease the personal income tax, which is the crux of the quote-unquote tax reform plan. Where it currently stands is a 7% automatic reduction in the tax rate starting January 1, 2018. After that, lawmakers are to set economic triggers, or goals, so to speak, that would have to be met before additional reductions in the income tax rate could take place. But those triggers aren't defined in the current version of the governor's bill.
You have to come up with great triggers.
Justice told lawmakers during his questioning that he felt the legislature should determine when it was appropriate to trigger an income tax reduction, whether it be based on revenue growth or job creation or something else altogether. But that wasn't something all of the members of the committee wanted to hear, including House Finance Chair Eric Nelson.
It's incumbent upon the administration to have some input in what those triggers should be, because no one knows those out-year numbers any better than you and your wonderful staff.
Nelson, along with several other Republican and Democratic members of the committee, pushed the governor for specific ideas. But the governor didn't provide a definitive answer. He did, however, offer some advice.
Be safe. Don't be unrealistic that they can't trigger because we want them to trigger, but be protective of our state and be safe.
So far, members of the conference committee were able to find some common ground on aspects of the tax reform plan. They proposed increasing the consumer sales tax to 6.5% from its current 6 and getting rid of a number of exemptions under the tax, charging the increased rate on cell phone bills, digital goods, gym memberships, and some other items starting January 1st of this year. They've also agreed to exempt military retirement and some Social Security income from the personal income tax and will continue a sales tax transfer of about $12 million a year to the state road fund. But the committee itself is made up of only 10 of the 134 members of the legislature, and some of those other 124 members are still reluctant to get on board, even though the conference committee is closer to a compromise.
If we do this and there's no growth, you are going to put us on the brink of disaster.
That's Democratic Senator Mike Romano on the Senate floor Thursday. Romano has spoken out against restructuring the income tax because he says it gives a break to some of the state's highest earners while placing a larger burden on middle and low-income families. The conference committee will return to its work Friday morning. The tax reform bill they're discussing is the base of the budget for the upcoming fiscal year, the budget that must be approved by June 30th to avoid a government shutdown. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Ashton Mara at the State House.
It's the time of year for summer camps, and maybe you remember going to summer camp or vacation Bible school as a kid. This week on Inside Appalachia, we'll travel back in time to hear a story about a small mountain community of young people during the 1950s who challenged the idea that blacks and whites should exist separately. The history of the civil rights movement is generally told in big, dramatic events like the Montgomery bus boycott or the Freedom Rides. Less well known is a history of quiet, grassroots activism that worked toward the same goals. One such effort was an integrated day camp that began in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1950. Beth Brigham, who attended the camp as a child, sent us this story from WMMT in Kentucky.
Oh, grandmother was involved in anything that involved civil rights. I mean, that grandpapa too, but grandmother was way more active. And obviously somebody mentioned that, and it was about integration, and of course she's going to be in favor of that. And as I said, the bus came by and picked us up.
The bus that picked up young Nikki Giovanni took her to Fellowship House Day Camp, a summer program in Knoxville, Tennessee that began in 1950 and continued until 1972. The camp was initiated by a small group of Knoxville women, including Giovanni's grandmother, who wanted to create an atmosphere for children in which they may develop understanding and appreciation of their neighbors here in the community and in the whole great wide world. The staff was aware that they were undertaking something that might have been a bit risky. Many of the organizers were members of the Unitarian Church in Knoxville, and this congregation had received threats when they accepted their first black member. Dick Henry was the Unitarian minister when the camp was started.
They began out of a desire to have a really important, significant program for the kids. And they were not going to have any questions asked about race. All comers would be welcome. And they were eager to have a cross-racial group of folks. Intentionally integrated. And there was a little hush-hushness about it as it got going. I remember thinking, well, we're off here in the mountains and they won't find us.
Ruth Martin, camp director in 1957 and 1958, described an incident on the way to taking campers to the Smokies.
We stopped to buy gas, and of course, you know, when you go get gas, you also do these other things. And so the girls immediately left the car to go to the bathroom. So they were gone from the car when the attendant got back. And he said, well, where are the girls? And I said, well, they've gone off to the bathroom. Oh, you know, that was just to him a terrifying idea that they would go to the white bathroom. So he got really livid and said, you know, when did they leave and when will they be back? And I remember just dragging my feet about it. We just loitered along. And pretty soon I saw the girls were coming slowly back from the bathroom, and that all was taken care of. We didn't think of ourselves as very, very brave, just a little maybe, because it just wasn't the way you did things back then. We were not flaming liberals at all. We would go along with the quiet way of getting things accomplished.
Well, what I remember, it was a fun camp to go to, and it was interracial. And as I recall, it's probably my first experience in any kind of interracial situation like that. And I think, as I say, the interracial part of it, that was a very progressive thing for the time, because, you know, being in a segregated society in the mid-50s, there wasn't hardly any interaction for children or adults. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of like, I think, an experiment to see how it would work. These walls of separation are coming down, and you see an experiment going forward. So I think it had a ripple effect.
Former camper Daniel Brown is in a position to know about the ripple effect the day camp may have had. He's on the Knoxville City Council and served as Knoxville's first African-American mayor. Nikki Giovanni put the importance of remembering and telling these stories in a different way.
And, you know, I think everybody appreciates the fact that, and she was not alone, all of those women. You know, that's what I'm saying. I think that working with the 70-year-olds is important because we're letting a lot of little stories that nobody thinks amount to much, but when you start to put them all together, you see how cities were changed because of women like my grandmother, you know.
That was writer Nikki Giovanni reflecting on the Knoxville Fellowship House Day Camp. This radio feature was produced with support from the Appalachian Sound Archives Fellowship Project at Berea College. For WMMT, I'm Beth Bingman.
You can hear a longer version of this story along with more summer-themed stories on Inside Appalachia this Sunday morning at 7 and again Sunday evening at 6. You can also download or subscribe to the Inside Appalachia podcast. You can find it on our website, wvpublic.org, or however you listen to your podcasts. Lovingly referred to as the first family of the banjo, partners in love, life, and music, Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn return to the Mountain Stage for an extended set on this week's broadcast. Here is Fleck and Washburn with Don't Let It Bring You Down on this Mountain Stage Song of the Week.
Don't let it bring you down, down, bring you down. Don't let it bring you down, down, bring you down. Don't let it bring you down, down, bring you down. Don't let it bring you down. One foot forward and one foot back. 20 times you fall off the track. One foot forward and one foot back.
Don't let it bring you down, down, bring it down. Don't let it bring you down.
That was Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn with Don't Let It Bring You Down. You can hear this song and more Saturday night at 8 on Mountain Stage right here on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, Marshall University, and Shepherd University. West Virginia Morning is produced with help from Glennis Board, Clark Davis, Jessica Lilly, Kara Lofton, Liz McCormick, Roxy Todd, and Jesse Wright. Our producer is Ashton Mara. I'm Teresa Wills.